Good afternoon. So, last time, we started off by talking about some logistics, and then we went into the traditional way of implementing an operating system after briefly talking about what an operating system is. Talked about this idea that since we want to run multiple applications and protect them from each other and not allow every application, even though we run it directly on the CPU, to do everything that the system is capable of doing, we have this separation between kernel and user mode implemented by our hardware, where our hardware will reserve certain operations for the OS. And the mechanism it has for doing that is it tracks whether it's in what we call kernel mode, and if so, it allows the OS operations, otherwise it doesn't. And the OS arranges for all programs that users write to run in user mode, and only the operating system code to run in kernel mode. Now, one problem we have here is that we need some way of running OS code in kernel mode for several reasons. So one reason was, well, when some events happen, the operating system needs to handle them, and it needs to handle them using those privileged instructions. Like if I press a key on the keyboard, it needs to talk to whatever is giving the keyboard input. That's going to be a privileged instruction. We don't allow every program to go interact directly with the keyboard. The OS instead tracks what's supposed to happen with the keyboard input. You also mentioned that we don't want to let a program run forever, so we have some mechanism of running the OS even if that program is like running an infinite loop. And we also want it to be the case that programs can explicitly request that the OS do something that requires that those privileged operations. So one example is that we limit the memory a program can access using, we mentioned, address translation. That's a mapping set by the OS. And if we don't have that mapping be settable in user mode, which would be dangerous because then programs can manipulate memory they're not supposed to, then we need something in kernel mode to run to expand that mapping, to allocate more memory. So we have a mechanism where programs can request that the OS do something on their behalf. And all of this is handled using one hardware sort of set of functionality known as exceptions. And it's a control mechanism for both switching from user to kernel mode. And the basic idea is it runs a handler that the operating system set up on boot. That's at a well-known location with carefully written code that the operating system uses to decide what to do in the case of whatever event triggered that exception. So we also looked a bit at XV6. We did a little brief demonstration, and as you know, the assignment that's due a week from Friday, you should get that working, and you're going to add a couple system calls to XV6. And as part of helping you understand how system calls work and helping you start on that assignment, we went through the path of the write system call in XV6. And I'll review that in a bit, but talked about how we had the user space part, this wrapper function that actually had the special trigger and exception instruction. And then we went into this common entry point for exceptions in XV6 and that trap function. From there, we figured out, oh, this is a system call, and we figured out which particular system call it was, and eventually called the actual handler for that, which then retrieved the arguments and did the write operation. And then we returned back into the user program, back to user mode. So before I move on to topics for today, any questions about anything we covered last time? No. So, as a piece of logistics, I mentioned last time we're going to have weekly quizzes. So I'm going to show how this works so you all know how they work. So we're going to have a quiz page that looks something like this. The actual one is this one, but I'm not going to use the demo because these quizzes aren't open yet. So we have week-by-week quizzes. Numbers, the open time, and the close time. I have them opening at 8 p.m., so I have time after this class to make sure I don't ask questions about things we didn't talk about. And that actually happens. And they close at 12:15 p.m. The other section's at 12:30, and I prefer people in the other section do not complete the quiz during lecture. I'm sorry that this prevents you from completing the quiz just before lecture, but I'm asking the same questions. And so the way this works, if you haven't seen this interface before because you didn't take 3330 with me, which is not unlikely, is that you're going to open the quiz. It will ask if you really want to. When you look at it, you'll have questions. You can have multiple choice questions. And when you select an answer and see where the answer bubble is from far away, the box around it will turn green. If it turns yellow with a red border, then your answer is not recorded. For example, maybe you're logged out of NetBadge or your Wi-Fi disconnected or something, but your answer is not recorded. So please note that. In addition to selecting an answer, you can write a comment, you know, something about this answer, like probably more specific. And when you focus out of there, it will record it and it'll be green. We will eventually have either me or some TA read all the comments for all questions with wrong answers and decide whether you actually understood what was going on and we should give you credit, or whether like the question was broken and we should give everyone credit. But this is the way to handle, like, I think you made a typo in this question and it doesn't make any sense. Write a comment explaining that, rather than like trying to frantically find me in time and ask me. Also, notably, I'm going to be very limited on clarifications I'll give to questions because, you know, I don't want it to be the case that you need to know the clarifications on Monday morning, because that isn't very nice to the people who like try to do all the quizzes on Friday or something like that. That secretly, you actually have to do them on Monday, even if you like have class in the morning, to actually get all the really clarified versions. So instead, I'm going to like try to do the best I can with those questions and possibly like drop options or something if the question was really bad. So we have multiple choice questions. We might have select all that apply questions and free response questions where you type in an answer. And if you tab away, there's that. So once you submit these, they're submitted. If it's turned green, it's logged. You can check if your answer is submitted, because if you go back to the main quiz page, like from the main course webpage, and you open up it again, you should see your answers there. That's if you're unsure, was my answer really recorded? That's the way to check. Just go back to the course webpage, open up the quiz again. If your answers are there, they're recorded. We got them. So on. After the quiz is due, it will be automatically graded, and you can go to the grading webpage, something like this. So I have the answers I entered marked and the comment I entered marked. We have the percentage of people who gave each answer. So you can get an idea of how confused was the class about this question, or more importantly, I can get an idea of how confused the class was. We have your comment. If a grader has read your comment, which will not happen immediately, we don't just sit here at 12:15 p.m. and frantically read all the comments, then there may be a reply to your comment indicating any adjustment in grade. If we haven't read it yet, it will still be graded and there will be no reply. And we'll eventually get to it, but it will probably take like a week or two or three. That's for all these questions. Since it is graded automatically after the closing deadline, I can't do extensions for the quiz. If you are sick or have some other good reason that you can't take the quiz, we will do something else. But I can't just give you an extension because anyone can open this up and get all the answers. And that's not a very reasonable way of giving you one person an extension when the answers are just there. In some prior classes that use this tool, there may have been drop quizzes. I'm not intending to drop any quizzes. Okay, so questions on quizzes. Yes?
Why are there no quizzes being dropped this semester?
I have never dropped any quizzes in this course.
Okay.
Yeah.
The promise can only help you get some points back if you click the right answer but put a comment that's wrong. You get points off?
We generally don't read the comments if the question was entirely correct. If it's a select all that apply question, then your comments, and you got partial credit, you could get less partial credit or no credit because of your comment. Generally, yeah. Usually, I haven't done that, but like if it obviously indicates that you answered it partially right for completely wrong reasons, then that would be a problem. But we just aren't going to look at them if it's auto-graded correct, just because I don't really want to put TAs to read like 200 comments per question. Other questions? Okay, so that's on that. So last time we finished up on talking about the write system call. And one thing that was kind of subtle in here is that we had a separate stack. So when we mentioned that when we have this wrapper function that triggered the exception, that executed in user mode and with the user stack. And when the exception happened, the hardware not only started our exception handler function, it also switched stacks, and we used a completely different stack to handle the kernel part. So we're going to talk a little more about what that means today, and we're also going to talk about what about the other exceptions and how they're handled. And we're going to spend a lot of time on probably one of the most confusing things we talk about in this class, which is how do we switch between processes? And it turns out that how we switch between processes in XV6 is going to be very integrated with how we handle exceptions. So first, just some brief reminder. So something which might help like think about how the write system call works is that, remember, we had the special instruction to trigger an exception. It triggered a particular kind of exception, which was encoded in the instruction. That was used both by the hardware to do the lookup, and later on, this vector64 function stashed the information about what kind of exception it was, and we checked in trap to figure out, oh, this is a system call. Even though all the exceptions go through trap, that's we knew because that was recorded earlier. We needed to figure out that this was not just only a system call, but the write system call. And the way that worked is our system call wrapper stored a number that meant write in the EAX register, and we read that in the syscall function from the registers that were saved down here. So we couldn't read it from the real EAX because the trap function like used EAX for other stuff, like temporary values. And then finally, we need to get the arguments, and we read the arguments from the user stack. So what this means is that in syswrite, we have some utility function that's called, you see, argint and things like that, that look at the saved registers, and they find the user stack pointer in here. It's the stack pointer that existed just before the exception was triggered. So they look at that stack pointer, and they compute, based on the calling convention, where the argument should be, and read them from there. So any questions about any part of this process? Partly because it'd be nice to understand it for the homework. So speaking of the homework. So the homework has two parts. So one part is we're going to add a new system called XV6 called write count. The write count system call should return the number of times a call to the write system call has happened. So it's going to be a new system call. And to implement it, you're also probably going to need to modify the write system call too. Imagine it would be hard to implement without that. And you're at a second new system call called set write count, which should set or reset the counter. So the idea is you can like set write count of 0 and then start counting up from 0 the number of write calls. In prior semesters, we didn't have this second system call. We have it this semester because in future XP6 homeworks, you'll need to add system calls with arguments. And it turned out that people had more trouble with that than they should. And we'd like to get it over with next week rather than in several weeks when you have other things in your mind. Okay, and basically the procedure for adding this is that, well, you're going to implement the system call function. And if you remember when we talked about how syswrite ran, there were arrays and tables and so on. And typically what you do is you'll look at, well, what happens for some other system call? Let's just do the same thing. And that's probably how you're going to add each system call. You're going to just look at where did they need to mention, add a number for this, where do they add an entry to this table, and just do all the same things for your new system call. Part of the homework is to create a program that tests your system call and both of your system calls, which you should do because otherwise how are you going to possibly know you implemented it correctly? Also because it's kind of important to know how to add programs like applications and run them in XP6, so we want you to have a little experience doing that. Okay, so questions about the homework? Yeah?
Can we just add a global to syscall.c to get a counter?
Question is, can your counter just be a global? Absolutely. We have no restrictions on you adding globals to XV6. This is not a anti-global variable class. We're in favor of global variables. I mean, even if we aren't, XV6 kind of uses a lot of them already. So it's not going to be a big deal. Other questions? Okay. And one minor note, when doing the homework and looking at some of the existing code we say to look at, you might see use of acquire and release. This is to handle multi-core stuff. And we're going to talk about how this works later in the semester. We're running all your stuff in a single core emulated mode, precisely so you don't have to deal with this yet. Later on in the semester, we'll talk about it, but don't worry about where you see acquire and release stuff and some of the existing code for now. If you want to make it work with it, that's fine, but it's not necessary. So I mentioned we had here user stack and kernel stack. And so we should talk about, well, address translation again, because mentioned that, well, we have separate address mappings for things. And one thing you might notice is we have some area for OS data, and on this sort of notional picture, I have them both pointing to the same slot. And this is sort of what XV6 does. So in XV6, we have our program addresses. This is before the mapping on the left side here, and the actual addresses on the right. And XV6 sort of divides the program addresses into two halves. The larger addresses are for the kernel, and they only work in kernel mode. If you try to access them in user mode, they trigger an error. And this is where XV6 keeps all of its kernel information around. And these smaller addresses in green down here are where the user stuff is. And to keep things simple for the kernel, XV6 is a very simple way of deciding what the addresses in the blue part map to in real memory addresses. It's just one-to-one. So this address at the bottom here is real address 0. That plus 1 is real address 0 plus 1, and so on all the way to the end of real memory, essentially. So that's very simple. And the user part, well, that varies depending on what the program running has allocated. And because we have mappings for all of the available memory in this blue part, that means that in the user part, we're going to have, you know, this mapping, this is, say, the user stack, that's going to also have a location in real memory, which is going to have two mappings, one in the blue part, one in the green part. And that's fine. And that's what XV6 does. So I mentioned we have a user stack, so the user stack's down in that green part, and we allocate a separate memory location with a different physical address for our kernel stack. So somewhere up there, we allocate a kernel stack, and XV6 arranges so that the processor, x86 has this feature where it will switch stacks on an exception, so the processor switches stacks as part of executing that exception handler function. And it switches to this stack that's allocated. It's stored in the special register so the processor knows where it is. So there's some code in XV6 which sets that register. And actually, there are multiple kernel stacks. So every single user thread, basically every program that's running, has its own kernel stack. This is not something XV6 had to do, but it's a design decision they made because they felt it made things simpler. So this means that that special register is going to need to be changed when we switch between programs because we want to use whatever program's currently running kernel stack to handle exceptions while that program is running. So we allocate one stack per user thread up here. And this is actually a very common OS design. So it's probably most common that OSs will have one stack in the kernel for every thread that runs in the user space, which will have a separate stack. So part of this is that they want to keep the stuff the kernel is doing separate from the user. They don't want broken user code to break what the kernel is doing. And that would be a really, really big concern if we decided, why do we have two stacks? Let's just have one. Problem is, what if the user does something silly on their stack? Now our kernel code is broken. And having a separate kernel stack avoids that issue. Now, another thing we could do is we could have one stack per core. So we could say, we don't need to have a separate stack for each program because we're only doing one thing at a time anyways per core. So we could just have one stack and share it between everything that's running on the core. And the reason OSs like XV6 choose not to do this is that this makes it trickier. It's not impossible, but trickier to write things like system call handlers. Like, let's say a program makes a system call saying, I would like to read from the keyboard. And we don't have keyboard input yet. What we're going to want to do as part of that system call is wait for input from the keyboard. If we only have one stack per core, we need to store the information about what that program is doing somewhere before we come back to it. With one stack per user thread, the place we store it is on that stack. On that kernel stack, we just keep it in a local variable and use another stack while we're waiting. And this is the design XV6 has chosen. And so that's like the primary advantage, is that we have this sort of easier way of writing our code where we have to do things like wait for something to happen, is that we wait, we just keep all our local variables around because they're on our stack, and switch to something else while that's happening, rather than needing to explicitly stash them somewhere. Now, the big disadvantage, and a reason you might not want to use this strategy, is that it uses more space. So, for example, in XV6, each of those kernel stacks is 4 kilobytes. So that means that if you want to run a program on XV6, no matter how simple your program is, we're going to allocate 4 kilobytes for it. And in fact, it's 4 kilobytes that the program's application code, its user code, can't even use. Can't touch that. It's kernel stuff. That seems like awfully wasteful. We could do a lot better than that. And there's some OSs which really try. Sort of a disadvantage, especially if you like have a very constrained environment. So another thing about these separate stacks is that XV6 made the decision that it switches stacks to the kernel on an exception from user mode. But we also have the question of like, what happens if we have an exception while we're running in kernel mode? So like, what happens if we're running a system call and the system call takes a long time, so you get a timer expires during it and we want to switch to another program? In XV6, that can happen. But the way it's handled is it's handled on the same stack that was handling the system call. That's just the choice they made. And it turns out that x86's stack switching support understands that we're still on the same stack and doesn't switch again. Okay. So So any questions on this user versus kernel stack issue? So this address here, labeled kernbase, is this is address on this side is 0x8000000, which corresponds to real address 0. So this means that on this mapping, we have kernbase here corresponds to address 0 over here. Does that make sense? And this is showing, yeah, this is the mapping. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we talked about system calls. So let's go through how Xv6 handles other exceptions. Because there's many kinds of exceptions Xv6 needs to handle which aren't system calls. So one example is our timer interrupts. So Xv6 uses a virtual timer the processor supplies. And this basically acts the same way as sort of like an I/O device, like a keyboard or something like that, which like just gives you a signal every so many milliseconds. So XV6 uses that signal to, you know, make sure programs don't run for too long, to allow a program to say, hey, I want to wait for 10 seconds. That's how it implements all that. We also have faults, which is the name I'll use for when a program does something it's not supposed to do. So these are exceptions which are triggered by some particular instruction, but aren't deliberate. So like dividing by 0 or accessing invalid memory, like if a program tries to access the kernel stack address, it's not going to work because that's the kernel stuff. It's going to trigger one of these exceptions. And also I/O, that if we need to like communicate with the keyboard or with the hard drive, that the device is going to give us exceptions to let us know it has data ready or it's ready for data. We'll talk a lot more about how that works probably in the second half of the semester, but there's some mechanism for that. So to make these work, we have to fill in more of the interrupt descriptor table, the interrupt table. We saw very briefly that we filled in the entry corresponding to our deliberate system call exception. XV6 also sets all the other entries. So there's this loop right above the code I already showed you for filling in the system call entry, which fills in all the other entries. There's 255 of them, or 256 of them, 0 to 255. Just fills all the other ones in, pointing to essentially the same sort of code. It's a different line of code because it has slightly different metadata in the table than for system calls, but otherwise it's effectively the same. And these all go to little pieces of assembly code, which, like for system calls, call the trap function after saving all the registers. Okay, so we're going to get into the trap function. So all the interesting things about how these other types of system calls, sorry, other types of non-system call exceptions are different than system calls is going to be whatever the trap function does. So let's look at first, what the trap function does for these, the program did something weird. And this is handled in the default case of our trap handler. So it has a big switch. There's some code after here, but a big switch which says what type of trap was it? And this is a number stored when the registers are saved, saying was it a system call? Was it something else? And if it's not any of the types that are handled normally, there's some default code. First, there's some code I've omitted, which does essentially the same thing as this, but does a different message for errors in kernel mode. But for if a user program is running and triggers like divided by 0, you'll get a message saying, this is the program that was running, and this is the type of error which happened. This is about CPU. You also have some other useful data in there. So one thing to note about this is that output in this message is the raw trap number. So a more featureful OS would look up and say, is this type of exception number, what does it mean? Is it a segmentation fault? Is it a divide by zero? Is it a floating point error? XV6 doesn't do that for you. It just prints out the number because they wanted to keep things simple. But you can look up in traps.h to figure out what the name is, unlike a real OS where you'd get something like segmentation fault or bus error, which is arguably useful, maybe. Here you'll just get a number. There's also some other information in here. So it prints out what process was running. We'll talk about process IDs next time. It prints out what is labeled as EIP here for instruction pointer. So it prints out the code which was running, the instruction, the address of the instruction in particular that was running when this happened. And it also prints out any associated address. And after it prints out that message, it kills the program. And there's some code that I omitted from the slide down here, which handles actually making sure the program gets exited. And as other part is in this dot, 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 there's similar code. So it's essentially the same message being printed out for errors in the kernel itself, but when there's like a bug in the OS code, it just crashes the system rather than trying to kill the current program because it assumes something else is more broken. But otherwise, it prints essentially the same message. But of course, that code in the dot, dot, dot shouldn't trigger except if there's a bug in XV6. Whereas this code here, nothing's wrong with XV6. It's just the programmer running. That's broken. And that should be fine. So questions about this? Okay. So another thing we need to handle is communicating with I/O devices. So that's another type of exception which has a whole bunch of cases in this trap function. So most of the I/O devices have trap numbers which are based on this thing called IRQs, which we're not going to talk about much, but that's why you see this IRQ0 plus an offset to identify which it is. So we have, for example, here IDE is the type of disk interface that XV6 accepts. So this code in IDE inter handles communicating with a hard drive. This code in keyboard inter handles communicating with a keyboard. This code in UART inter handles communicating with a serial port, which is, for XV6's purposes, basically like a keyboard. So we have code which handles that. And then we have this LAPIC-EIO function, which seems to be used every time. So that's a function to tell the hardware, hey, I handled this exception. It's done, which we have to do for these I/O communication exceptions. We have to say, I'm done handling this communication with the device. Please don't tell me about it anymore. That's what that's there for. And sometime later in the semester, we'll go in more detail about what's in these special functions here when we talk about how our device is actually connected to our CPUs. So you also have our timer interrupt. So the timer interrupt appears like a device, like a keyboard, except it just triggers periodically to let us know some amount of time has passed. So there's a handler for timer interrupts. And it does a couple things. And the most notable part isn't in the switch statement, but it's down in the bottom of the trap function. And that's this code here. If we're running a program, that's the first part, and we got a timer interrupt, then we call this yield function. And what the yield function does is it maybe possibly switches to another program. So this is how we keep an infinite loop from running forever, that as it's running, eventually we'll get this timer will expire and it will stop running and we'll start running the OS in this trap function and we'll figure out, oh, the timer expired. Let's see if there's another program I want to run instead. So another thing that happens on a timer interrupt is that we increment a count of ticks. And based on that, we decide whether we want to wake up programs which ask to be put to sleep for a certain amount of time. So the Xv6 has a system call to say, please let me wait for so many units of time. And after that many units of time, run me, or try to run me. And the way that works is that that wake up function will set that those programs as runnable. So later on, when we call yield, those might be switched to. And notice that we also have, just like for communicating with the device, we have to tell the hardware, yes, I'm done handling this timer interrupt. Don't tell me about it until the next one. So any questions about our timer handling? Okay. So the effect of having this yield operation is that we end up doing what we know as time multiplexing, that we divide each CPU core in time between different programs based on when the yield function gets run, how often the timer goes off, and how often it decides to actually switch to another program. And the effect is that if we're running a program, then an exception happens, and we return into a different program. So somehow that yield function is ending up returning from somewhere else, some other program. We're going to talk about how that works. So what conceptually happens is we're starting running, the OS instead of a neural program, and somehow we have to save the old program counter and the register somewhere. And then we have to set the registers for the new thing we're running and the new program counter. And this is what we know as a context switch. And it's called a context switch because the things we're saving and restoring, whatever the yield function is switching between, is our context. And conceptually, this is all our register values and our condition codes and our program counter. So all our registers, including these sort of hidden registers. These are you might not think of as registers directly, but there really are registers. And also our address space if we're switching between processes, which we'll talk about the details of how it works more, but for Xv6, it's represented by the page table base pointer. So basically, we start out in a situation where we're running in user mode, process A, the CPU registers contain stuff that points to processes A's memory, and actually access it. And somewhere in the OS's memory, we stashed earlier a copy of processes B's registers. And then an exception happens, and in the exception handler, we decide, I really want to be running process B. And after we return from the exception, we've ended up in a situation where we have process A's registers stuck in the OS's memory somewhere, and process B's registers are in the CPU. So this is known as a context switch. And in Xv6, the way context switches work, as I said, is very integrated with exceptions. And in fact, we've already seen where the location is that process A's registers are going to be saved. And that location is the trap frame on the kernel stack for A. Because we save those registers in the exception handler, regardless of whether we're switching to another program, we're just going to reuse that as the place where we save the user registers in general. We'll talk about how that works in a bit, but first, do a little interlude. So, a little exercise. So let's say I have a system, I'm running two programs. So I'm running program A, which is just running an infinite loop. So it always wants to run, and presumably our operating system is going to run program A rather than running nothing. So we're not going to leave our single core idle. Assuming we have a single core, which will make things easier, we're going to run program A. Let's say process B asks to read some input from the keyboard. After that input's available, then it reads some data from a file. Then it does a computation, and then writes the result to a screen. So process B is running, and in the background, process A is hogging all the compute time it can get, despite what process B manages to get done. So I have two questions here. So one is, while this is happening, how many system calls do I expect? And my second question is, how many context switches do I expect? And as it says, your answers might not be single numbers, but might be ranges. Give you like 60 seconds or so. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what you think the answer should be. Who would like some more time? Okay. Anyone want to volunteer an answer to the first part? How many system calls do we expect? Back there?
Four.
So where did you get four?
So we know that B is going to take a keyboard input.
Okay.
It's going to read to the file.
Okay.
Read from a file.
Yeah.
It's going to do the computation and then send it right on the screen.
So do a computation right on the screen is? Okay, so I agree that writing on the screen is a system call. I don't think computing is a system call, like likely to be a system call, because like that's not a kernel service that we need kernel mode to do. We can do all our computation without help from the kernel. So I don't think we need that. So I got 3 from that. Any higher numbers for other reasons? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying we're counting system calls.
Oh, system calls.
Yes. So.
Does it never like automatically?
So, we're asking about system calls.
Yes.
So there might be switching,
yes.
But that switching is not an extra system call.
Okay.
We're switching during a system call, for example. We still have only one system call, even though we switched away from B during the system call. Yes. Yeah, so one nitpicky thing is, does the infinite loop have any system calls? Let's assume not, to keep things simpler. Other reasons. So someone tell me, when you read from a file, what do? Like in some programming language, like what operations do you do to read from a file? What does that look like? Yeah. You have to open the file first. So this might be 2 or more, depending on whether we can actually do the open and the read all at once. And also, we might have to read more than once if it's like, because like often you read, you have a, like a loop to get all the data in the file. So it could easily be more than one system call there. So that'd be a reason to have some extra system calls. And similarly, we might have some extra system calls for writing to the screen, maybe if we can't write it all at once with one system call. Like if we're writing a whole lot of stuff to the screen, maybe that doesn't work. We don't do it in one system call, or it doesn't fit in one system call. So that would be one way you could get extra system calls there. Yeah?
Did you have a hardware timer interrupts while the input is waiting?
So the question is, could we have a timer interrupt while the input is waiting? Absolutely. That doesn't increase the number of system calls. It does affect our second part, which I'm about to get to. But it doesn't change the number of system calls. System calls, remember, are things that the program is doing itself. So how about the second part, which, yes, might be impacted by timer interrupts? How many context switches do we expect? Someone have an answer? I'm not looking. Yeah.
So it sort of depends on where you start.
Okay.
With a little bit. But assuming you start A, which is what I did when I was walking through it.
Okay.
You'll eventually hit a timer interrupt, which will send you back to B, which would be 1. And then B will basically put out a call to do the keyboard thing, and then maybe it'll switch back to A, so we can call that 2. Eventually, B will get the read, which will be getting info from outside, which could be 3, and then B will probably just do the computation and write without switching back to A then.
So you're going to do read, okay, and that's the computation and writes, and then
eventually it'll switch back to A again after that.
Okay, so that's your guess for maybe 3. So wait, we could imagine so there's a bunch of ways we could have more. So one way we could have more is that we could do this same switching back to A for waiting for the disk, you know, if the file wasn't available right away. But yeah, that's a good idea. And that's similar to the sort of answer I got. And the way you could get a bunch of extra is that, well, if B takes long enough to do its computation, then maybe we'll have timer interrupts during that, and we'll switch back and forth between A and B, and could go as high as you want, pretty much, depending on how long that takes. Yes?
Can a program switch from itself to itself?
Question is, can we have a context switch from A to A? And we will not call that a context switch. Even if we run the same code we would run to switch from A to another program. Other questions? Yes?
So when you switch to A while you're waiting for disk, once disk is done, does it automatically switch back to B?
It's question is, once disk is done, does it automatically switch back to B? So the OS is capable of doing that, because when the disk is done, it's going to trigger an exception, and the OS will run. And you might think that the OS will always do that, but that varies. But the OS has the option of doing that. And in practice, the OS will sometimes switch immediately, and sometimes it will let A finish writing for a while and then switch. Okay. Other questions?
Can we not assume there's one more at the end when it goes back to A if it's an infinite loop?
The question is, can I assume there's one more at the end? Yes, you could have one more at the end. It's just a question of, I just interpreted the question as saying that we stop counting right here, when the results are on the screen. But that wasn't unambiguous. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
What happens when A's process stops from the timer interrupt?
What happens when A's process stops from the timer interrupt? So then the OS runs and decides whether or not it wants to run B. And most likely, in this scenario, like, the best choice would be to run B if it's able to run, because it probably deserves the CPU more than A, and otherwise, if only A can run, you might as well keep running A. We'll talk in 2 weeks about, like, more specifically how we might make that choice, but when the timer interrupt happens, it's a policy decision, basically, where it depends on what are our priorities for our OS as far as, like, what is important to run quickly. Yes? So what's the minimum number of context switches we could possibly have? So the absolute minimum is probably zero. Because what could happen is, let's say the keyboard input was already read in, and the file was already read in, so the system calls didn't need to wait for anything. So the absolute minimum is probably zero in this case. But if we had to wait for keyboard input, we'd expect at least one for that. If we had to wait for the file input, we expect at least two for that, one to start waiting, one to finish waiting. And we had to wait for a file, we'd expect another two for that. Because, you know, we're gonna have to do a context switch to wait, because we're not gonna wait by just infinite looping on the CPU. But yeah, our best case is that somehow all the input is already available without waiting, and the system calls don't need to switch away. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about what context switch looked like in XV6. Now, I mentioned already that we're going to reuse our exception handling infrastructure. So when we do a context switch, we're going to enter the XV6 kernel for an exception. And we're going to save our registers, just like we do for all types of exceptions. And sometime while we're handling that exception, we're going to decide, no, I really want to be running B. And we're going to somehow switch between two different kernel stacks to B's kernel stack and continue running B. And when we exit this exception, we're going to exit not right into A, but into B. So we already went through this process here. How do we save the registers? We have some assembly code that's just going to copy the registers onto the kernel stack, pass a pointer to that to the trap function, and that code's going to run again to read those values from the kernel stack and restore them before going back to user mode. So the interesting part is, how does this code here that actually switches kernel stacks and starts running B work? And in XV6, this is a function called swtch. There's no I because that's a keyword. That was the way of dealing with that. And we're going to spend a bunch of time talking about how that works. So to explain this, we first have to talk about, well, where are we actually saving our information in XV6? And from here, we can see that it's kind of split. We save the user stuff in the place we save it for exceptions. And the switch function, we're going to need to store the registers just before we switched away. So we remember them later on when we go back to A. And we also somehow need to, have a pointer to this information that we can access when we decide to switch back to A so we can find A. We need to have some table where we can look up all the programs we could potentially switch to and know how to switch to each of them. So the way this works, six, I'm going to show sort of where is our context type information stored. And so we have, say, two programs here. And program A, it has a user stack, and it has a corresponding kernel stack. And we also have what we know as a process control block. This is just the structure where we store information about a process. And the kernel stack and the process control block are part of the kernel memory. And all this stuff is used together to effectively run process A. Now, when process A is running, when it's the active process, we can access all this stuff. This is its address space. So remember when I showed you our memory mapping with that blue region, I said we just have all of memory available. This means that in the kernel, and this below the dotted line is for the OS only, the OS is allowed to look at other processes just because that's simpler and because we aren't concerned about the OS accidentally messing with process B when it's not supposed to. We're responsible for making that code not buggy. So this is how we're going to be able to switch to B, even though it's not loaded in memory yet, because we can access all its stuff. So we also have a similar situation for process B. Now, the user stack, is going to be only accessible when that program is active, because we're not going to have the memory mapping set correctly until we switch. So we're going to need to store our saved information about our register values. So we have our saved user registers are at the beginning of each kernel stack. So A and B, when they went into their exception handler, they save those user registers to start that kernel stack. And then we run the exception handler, and we eventually get to some code where we decide, oh, I'm in the middle of running A, but I really want to switch to B right now because we're waiting for something or it ran for too long. So when that happens, we're going to save the kernel register so we can pick back up and stop waiting or go back to continuing the program on the kernel stack. But we need to remember where we saved those. We need to know where's the kernel stack pointer now. So we're going to save a copy of that stack pointer in the process control block. And we're going to have a global array of all the process control blocks. So that's how we're going to be able to figure out how to switch back to A later on. Because we're going to find that pointer. And that pointer is going to let us find the safe kernel registers. And that's going to let us find everything else we need to know. So these user registers, we already saw they're saved and restored just before and after we called trap. And this switch function we're going to show you is going to be what's responsible for saving and restoring the kernel registers on the stack. And we need to tell the switch function, well, where do we, we save and restore them. We need to know what to restore, where do we get those new registers. And we need to also remember, where did we save the registers. So the arguments to switch will represent these two pointers. So one of the arguments will be, where do I want to stash this pointer? So it will be the location of this pointer. And the other argument will be this pointer, so I know where to restore the new registers from so I can start executing B if I'm switching from A. So questions about this high-level view? So I said, yes. So where does the user stack pointer get saved? So the user stack is one pointer, is one of the user registers. And that's why I have this dotted line here. It represents exactly that register value. It's a good question. Yes. Other questions? Yeah. Yes, a structure. We'll talk about it next week, but specifically what it is in XV6. But it just has information about a process. Because we need to store that somewhere. Other questions? So I said we have this switch function. So here's the prototype for the switch function. So it takes a pointer to a pointer about where you want to save the context, and it takes a pointer to the thing we want to switch to. So in XV6, these have type struct context, but I think it's probably better just to think of them as that they're just a pointer to the kernel stack. So the first one's a pointer to the kernel stack. We're going to save, we're going to modify the pointer that points to point to where the stack actually ends up. And the second one's the new stack we want. And they use the type struct context because they know what's at the beginning of the stack in case they want to read out like some of these saved registers. But that's not really something we actually care about doing. So the struct context star is the thread stack pointer where all the saved registers are. And the switch function is kind of magical. Because we're going from one stack to the other, it has this sort of, it can go from one thread to another. So let's say in thread B, sometime earlier, we called the switch function here, and now we somehow ended up running thread A. We got switched to thread A, thread A is running here, and we call switch, and we say, I want to switch from A, so I want to save in A context, I want to save the place I switched from, and I want to go to B context, which was saved earlier. And what this call will do is it will end up returning from that prior call to switch in thread B. And then later on, maybe thread B decides to switch back to A. So it says, let's save my context where it was before, a new version of it, and switch to A, which was saved here. And making that call will return from this original call to switch and save information to go back here into B context. So if we called switch later from any thread, we return from here. Yes?
Is all this information stored on the processor, or is it like put into RAM?
So the question is, where is all this information stored? So what information do you mean?
Like all the save registers.
So the save registers, so I said here they were on the kernel stack, or in these control blocks, which were just global variables. So that's all in memory. Other questions?
From how you described it, it sounds like you kind of need to have a different different thread that's already called switch to have a place to be.
Yes. So a problem with this scheme seems to be that how do we do the first call to switch? So we're going to have a solution to that. We'll talk probably about it next time. The basic idea is we're going to manually construct a stack as if we had called switch without actually calling switch. But for now, we're going to kind of gloss over how that works and just assume we've already called switch before. Other questions? So let's talk about what this switch function, this switch call is going to do. So here's our pseudocode for switch, the way XV6 implements it. So first, we're going to save all the caller save registers to the stack. So I'm going to start by saving the caller save registers. Why did I write this as the first operation here? Yeah. Your answer or no? Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Returning to the call to save register needs to be the last thing that happens again. Like, you can do that first and then undo everything else.
Okay, so you're saying it's because it's something we're going to deal with later. That's part of it. So there's what trying to get is, why is that going to be the last thing that happens?
Because you want to return to the caller at the end of the whole process.
Okay, yeah. So the caller is going to restore those registers anyway. So something we're doing in XV6's implementation of switch is we're taking advantage of how function calls work. And part of how function calls work is that before you make a function call, you save the caller save registers, and after you finish a function call, you restore the caller save registers. So that means that this is already done by the compiler, as is this. maybe not that, but as is restoring the caller safe registers is already done by the compiler. And it's done by the compiler because it's part of calling a function as you save your caller safe registers. So the switch implementation doesn't actually need to do anything special for that to happen. It's just going to happen because that's how the compiler works. That's how calling a function works. And it also writes the return address to the stack, the second step, because that's part of call in x86. So this is already done by the compiler. So the way we're going to think about this is that, you know, that's free. So something about the pseudocode is that there's actually two stacks involved, because at this step here, we make a new stack pointer. So to keep things simpler, I'll color code the two stacks, and also bold italic in case you're viewing this in black and white. So that's our first step. And notice that this writing the return address to the stack, that's what the call instruction does in x86, so that's free. And using the saved return address is the return instruction, so that's free. And this call and return is how we save where we are in the kernel, what if statement we're in, that's saved there. So what's going to happen is first we save all the caller save registers along with the switch arguments to the stack, because that's just what the calling convention says to do. Then we call the function, save the return address. Now the function needs to save all the other registers to the stack. So it's going to push those to the stack. And then we need to stash this stack pointer I have here, which points to all those safe registers somewhere for later. So we're going to save that so we can retrieve it later. And we're going to retrieve a different thread's version of that pointer and make it our stack pointer. So now we're pointing to the mirror image in B, which already completed the same saving process. So that new stack pointer points to the exact call these save registers that we just saved, but B's version, not A's version. So we do the reverse of what we did for saving, but this time we're restoring B's registers because we're using B's stack instead of A's. So we restore all the call these save registers from the stack. We return using the return address. And then the code, which called switch in B, is going to know how to restore the caller save registers from B stack. Okay. And this is the in kernel part. So if we look at our diagram here, you may remember that this is this part here. And later on, we're going to end up returning to the user code in B, which means we're going to have to restore the registers from before the exception. And the way that happens is that they were saved in the trap, which is somewhere up the stack. And we'll read those there. But that's not actually part of the switch function. So questions about this process here? Okay, so this gives us this assembly. So here's our assembly for switch. First, we retrieve the arguments. In the 32-bit x86 calling convention, they're on the stack. So this is just retrieving the pointer to pointer and pointer. Then we push the call save registers, just a bunch of push instructions. Then we actually change the stack pointers. So we store the old stack pointer into the location pointed to by the first argument. We've saved an EAX up here. We take the second argument, make it our new stack pointer, and then pop things based on there, and then return based on what was on that stack. So conceptually, this is the part where we actually start running thread B. Here's where we were running thread A. Okay, so questions on this process? Okay, so that's our context switch. So there are a couple missing pieces here. So this is how we change the kernel stacks and the program counter. This is how we go from the kernel stuff for one program to the kernel stuff for another. We also needed to do the user register, so I mentioned that's done in trap. We also need to change the address translation mapping. So that's a separate function we'll talk about in more detail like in the second half of the semester when we talk about virtual memory, where we change the address translation mapping. We also need to say, here's where the stack pointer is used on an exception. So there's a separate function that changes that. And next time we'll talk about the, you know, still missing detail, how do we start a new thread? Because we haven't mentioned that. And that's a kind of an important step of, you know, doing this. And we, so far we only know how to switch to a thread which already called switch. So we need some way of starting a new thread which obviously hasn't called switch yet, which is going to require some sort of special case. So since we've gone over how context switches work, let's do this little exercise here. So suppose we're running, this is an XV6 program in assembly. If you don't know how to read AT&T syntax assembly, the comments have a translation of each instruction. So this is an infinite loop. And my question is, XV6 switches away from this program because it's an infinite loop and it's taking too long. Where is EAX going to be stored? I'll give you some time. You can test with your neighbor, see if you agree. More time? Okay, so who thinks that the answer is A? B? C? Okay, we have pretty unanimity on B, which is the correct answer. Okay, so I guess since we have a minute, let's do the alternate version. So same question, how about its program counter? Program counter when it was last running in user mode. Okay, so let's see who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay, so the correct answer happens to be B. It's in fact stored in the same place as EAX. Now, this is a bit tricky because you have to think of how was it saved. And this is something where, well, this is something the hardware for that handled exceptions needed to help us with. Because when the hardware that handled exceptions jumped to the exception handler, it needed to stash this program counter somewhere. And XV6, well, makes sure it's in that trap frame. So that's how it ends up there. It turns out that the place x86 saves it is on the kernel stack, but if it didn't, and x86 was like being implemented for like a different architecture, it would probably save it in the trap frame, just like it saves EAX in the trap frame, but it would save it from a different location, like maybe a special register. We wouldn't keep it in a special register because if we're switching to another program, how, like, we have like three programs running, aren't we gonna run out of those registers? You know, it might start there, but we can't keep it there indefinitely because that would limit the number of programs we could run. Okay, and that's what I have for today. Remember that we have a quiz before next class. See you next time.